Office, Rob Taylor.
One of the major issues that's facing most of us and that most of us are interested in is education, because the future of our country depends on how well educated our children are going to be. And right now we have a failure. Talk about systemic failure. I mean, you know, I was just talking about the Inflation Reduction Act. That's systemic corruption. But the school system is suffering from systemic failure. It's failing on all levels. And I would say, I would contend that the major reason is because there's no competitive market. There's no free market, certainly, in the school system. It's public school, damn if you do, damn if you don't. And in Oregon, we're just being damned because they just recently passed a law saying that kids don't even have to meet certain qualifications or standards to get their diploma. And what they're doing is they've made the Oregon diploma worthless everywhere else in this nation. Who's going to accept an Oregonian diploma when they know the standards are, well, if you can show up, we will pass you? And that's not a good idea. So a lot of parents are looking for school choice and they're not finding it in Oregon. So my next guest, she's from the Education Freedom for Oregon group, and we're going to be discussing school choice and a couple of ballot measures that they have available for you to sign petitions for. And her name is Donna Kreitzberg, and she's joining me right now on Zoom. Donna, how are you doing?
Great, thank you. Appreciate being here.
Oh, I appreciate you coming on, because this is something that I was really thrilled about when I saw Mark Thielman, he's the other chief petitioner, get involved with this, because a lot of times you see these people run campaigns, lose the campaign, and then go away wherever they came from. But Mark kind of was a stand-up guy, and he's filed this petition, and you were part of the political action committee, the other chief petitioner, who was a member of this. And why don't you tell us how you got involved with that?
Okay, well, last year, maybe it's 2 years now, I ran for the school board and met some wonderful people and ran on a campaign of just bringing schools back to reading, writing, and arithmetic, kind of the fundamentals, what the instruction should be, what schools should be.
Right.
And I lost, and I licked my wounds for a day, and then I thought, well, okay, maybe God has something else in plan for me. So I reached out to a lot of the folks that helped me on my campaign and said, you know, I've been thinking about school choice for years. You know, talk about it at the dinner table and think, gosh, if every kid is just worth, let's say, $10,000, and wherever the child goes, then that's the school that the money will go to. Just kind of a common sense. I didn't know all the technical definitions of school choice. It just sort of made common sense.
Right.
So I decided, okay, I'll just research and figure out what school choice really is. So I spent a lot of times knuckled down. I'm a former attorney, so I read statutes and I read case law, and I reached out to policy people and school choice advocates across the country in about 20 different states. And I said, you know, I want to bring this in Oregon, and you know, what do I need to know, and what can you help me with? And everybody was super excited. But the first thing they would always say is, hold on, you're in Oregon. You can't have freedom and choice and those sort of things in Oregon. And I said, yeah, we can. Oregon students deserve it just as much as anybody else. So last year, we put together a measure that had a small open enrollment and a private choice with education savings accounts. And we submitted it in September of 21. Secretary of State, kind of responding to the teachers union, threw us out in January of 2022 with some sort of cock and bull reasons. We negotiated with the Secretary of State a little bit to try to figure out if we could save the measure that we had. And then we decided, you know, it's going to be $100,000 and court system, and that's horrible. So
right.
I said, okay, wait, I'll just take the one we had and I'll break it apart and I'll redraft it. So I spent about 4 months again researching and drafted a standalone open enrollment constitutional amendment and a standalone private school choice with education savings account constitutional amendment. And we decided we had to do constitutional amendments because our government is hostile to the idea of freedom, and they're into mandates and you will do this and you won't do this and all that kind of stuff. And several legislators over the years have tried to bring various school choice measures, but they just can't even get them off the shelf to be discussed. So we knew we couldn't go that route. So we thought, okay, let's just do this as moms and dads. How do we want this to be school choice is the big thing. It's like a tsunami washing across the country. Last year was the year of school choice, with 18 states enacting 7 new and 21 improved programs. So we knew it's coming to the West Coast. So we decided to draft it from the perspective of mom, because I'm a mom. And I thought, okay, what do I want the open enrollment to look like for helping public school parents? And then on the private side, what do I want it to look like to help the parents who don't want to be in public school because the values don't align with what the parents believe, and that they don't like the curriculum, and for whatever reason, it's not meeting the needs of their children. So we basically drafted this from the perspective of mom. We made it what parent needs, and we're basically telling the government, look, Jack, this is what's going to happen. This is how it's going to be. We're bringing it through the Constitution because we want to cement the rights that we're giving to the parents in the Constitution. The Oregon Constitution is the supreme law of Oregon. It trumps legislation. So when our measures pass, they will nullify any existing statutes and legislation that conflicts with our measures, and there'll be a bulwark and a preemption to future legislation. If the legislators get a wild hair and think that they want to regulate private schools or regulate homeschools, we're going to say, no, no, can't do that. Once we have these rights cemented into the Constitution, they give back the power to the parents, and it'll be basically cemented in the Constitution to make the legislature sit up and take notice and say, okay, these are what the parents' rights are now, and we can't mess with that. So that's where we basically got to right now.
And so, you know, this one of the reasons I know that you had to do this differently is that any measure that you put on the ballot through the initiative process has to deal with a single subject. It's something that you have to deal with going through the Secretary of State. And I guess that was the reason that they gave you for making the you know, differentiating between the two.
Well, basically, there's single subject and then there's separate vote. They're two different issues. They're very similar.
Okay.
Well, we were fine on the single subject. Where we got hung up, according to them, was the separate vote. And they were trying to say that because we had both an open enrollment and a private choice, that there's a possibility that a parent could want one of those issues but not the other, and therefore we had to separate them. Now, there's an exception to that separate vote policy, which is closely related. We believe that they're basically all under the umbrella of school choice, whether it's public school parents or private school parents. But regardless of the snafu last year, we just decided it was more efficient to start over again, do separate measures, and now we feel very confident that these will pass. Again, we have two constitutional lawyers in Oregon working with us, and I've reached out to litigators and legislators and policy wonks across the country to have a look at the measures, give advice, give counsel to us. So we're, you know, we've really gotten a lot of coalition building of various people across the country who have been doing this a lot longer than we have, to give input on our measures. So we do have all of our signatures that we needed for this first phase. You have to submit for each petition 1,000 valid Oregon voters, and the most you can turn in is 2,000. And with such a success, we have like 2,500 each on each petition. So we're going through right now, and we're gonna send in basically like a FIFO. I'm an accountant too. So the first signatures that came in, we'll process those and submit them. And then we'll tell the other folks who signed the petition that we weren't able to use them now, so they're freed up to sign it in phase two when we go out next year to get 250,000 per signature.
Clarify that timeline for me. When did you go out and get the original set of signatures that you have before you can go out and do the whole petition? What was the timeline on that?
Okay, for this one, for 2022, we submitted our two measures on May 25 of 22, and then basically the beginning of June, we started saying, hey guys, we're back, we're ready to get signatures. So for all of June and July, we reached out to people. We had a huge response, lots of volunteers, lots of fairs, lots of meetings, lots of people sending in, and we knew we wanted to get close to 2,000. Well, we just got, you know, a wash with signatures. I mean, they were pouring into my mailbox, and it was all across the country or all across the state. A huge response, which is phenomenal. So we are now then going through them and making sure we can read the handwriting. Some people write like I do, which is illegible, and so those are a little more challenging. And we want to submit really clear, crisp, easy signatures so that we have a success rate very high, because all the ones that are accepted in this phase one count toward the ultimate collection of signatures. So we can only submit 2,000. We're about to do that. probably this week, and then the Secretary of State will take 10 days to look at all of the signatures we submit. They do a statistical sample of those to make sure. And last year, our kickout rate was less than 10%. And
nice.
For various reasons. They couldn't find the person's address. They couldn't read the signature, whatever. So we always know that some are going to get thrown out. But if we turn 2,000 in, we will easily make the 1,000 required. And after that, then the Secretary of State turns it over to the Attorney General and says, okay, they passed the first test. Now give them a draft ballot title for each measure. And that will happen approximately at the beginning of September.
Nice, nice. And so were you able to keep the signatures? Because you said you had a big response to this. So are you going to be able to keep those other signatures, or are people going to have to re-sign again? Because I know I signed, but I don't know whether I was one of the 2,000 who were involved. So do you get to keep the signature, or do you got to go get the signature repeated again by the
signer? Well, it's a nice problem to have. We didn't have it last year. So this year, since we have more than 2,000, if we submit 2,500, the Secretary of State is going to nullify those extra 500. And that would be tragic. We don't want that to happen.
Right.
So what we're going to do is we're going to take kind of a first in, first out. The first 2,000 that we have, we will submit those. And then for the extra, the 500 or so that we can't submit, we're going to make up a little postcard and we're going to mail it out to them and say, thank you so much for signing. We couldn't use you in this phase. You are now freed up to sign in the second phase when we come looking for 250,000. Because we want everybody's voice to count. So we will notify you either, if you don't get a notice, that means you got submitted in the first time. If you get a little postcard, it means we couldn't use you in this phase one, you're freed up to sign in phase two.
Do you think the Secretary of State makes this purposely so convoluted that people eventually give up? You know, it seems like they just seem to make these rules that just make it hard for people to go gather signatures. And I've done dozens of initiatives myself, and I always think, why are you guys so obstinate to making this more user-friendly, I guess?
Well, my personal opinion, this is only the second time I've been involved in this, is that I think they want all the power set in the legislature or in the organizations that are just, you know, the czars and so forth. And they don't like it when the people stand up and say, you know, this is a consent by the governed and we're the consent people and we don't like what you're doing. We want to do something on our own. And I think that that ruffles the feathers of the government. So they try to make it as difficult as possible for ordinary folks to submit something that they want to become a law. So again, over the last 20 years or so, I think they keep pushing their thumb down and making it harder and harder to do these initiatives. And I know even between when we filed last time and this time, they made some law of changing some things. And, you know, it's baffling to figure out how complicated this is. You think it'd just be, hey, I've got this idea. This is what I want. Here's a bunch of signatures that show that people want it. Can we put it on the ballot? But, oh, no, it's got to be quite convoluted and expensive and time consuming. So, but we're just going to put one foot in front of the next and just keep trudging along because this is such an important issue. We have to save Oregon by saving the education system.
And I couldn't agree with you more. One of the things that most of you parents out there, and I'm a grandparent, I did have a parent in abandoned school, and we didn't really get much choice. We didn't get to decide really where our kid went because it was limited on what our choices were, especially out here on the South Coast. But I think if the money that is distributed to each child to go to school, that if that money was dedicated to allowing that child to decide where they wanted to go, you would induce competition into a system that, well, as far as I'm concerned, has failed. And so I'm talking right now to Donna Kreitzberg. She's from the Education Freedom for Oregon. And Donna, I know that one of the things that if you want to discuss something, jump right in. But I did have a question about how, you know, because a lot of people don't understand how are you going to do it this with these tax dollars? You know, how are you going to be able to take that money, be able to have it and decide what you want to do with it? How is that going to be set up?
Well, basically, we need to understand what this money is and what it is not. Basically, we all pay taxes. Some of the taxes that we pay through property tax, income tax, the CAT tax, lottery tax, blah, blah, blah. Some of it is earmarked for education. And so we have Oregon dollars and then we have federal for Title 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So we have a whole bunch of money in a big pot. We're only looking at the state school fund pot. So we're not looking at any of the federal money. And within that state school fund pot, there are basically, when you take the pot, there's $5 billion into the year. And then the governor carves out things for whatever she wants to do, put it in her pocket, and then have some carve outs for statutes and grants and all sorts of things. Then you come down to a numerator. Then they divide that by the weighted average number of kids. There's about 550 bodies of public school students, but some of those kids are weighted a factor of two if they have one of 86 different qualifications, whether it's disability, pregnancy, poverty, and so forth. So they take the numerator of the money left over, divide it by the weighted average number of kids, and then they get a quotient. And that quotient is somewhere in the 9,000 mark. It's about 15,000, anywhere up to 51,000. I had a mole from the Multnomah County Public School tell me that the cost over there is really like 51,000. But if you take an average number of 15,000, then the state portion is approximately 9,000. We're just taking 80% of that number. So we aren't taking any of the federal, we aren't taking any of the grants, we aren't taking any of the carve-outs, and we're only taking 80% of this quotient. And what that will do is it'll say, if little Johnny's in public school and he walks out the door and he wants to go into the private school arena or the private sector, he can take 80% with him. And then the public school will retain, even though they're not responsible for educating little Johnny anymore, they'll retain all that federal money, all those carve-outs, all those grants, and that 20%. So what other industry do you have where you can have a company that's no longer responsible for selling a product and they still get money?
Right.
So it's kind of ridiculous when the unions say, oh my gosh, you're going to defund public schools. No, we're actually going to give them more per capita than they had before because little Johnny walked out the door. But so anyway, so when little Johnny walks out the door, he takes 80% with him, and basically his parent has opted out of the public system, given a name to the Oregon Department of Education saying little Johnny is no longer in the public system. We would like this money to be put into an education savings account for little Johnny. And once the money goes from the state and follows little Johnny into that education savings account, it no longer is government money. It becomes effectively the money of the parent to be used only for little Johnny's education. So it's through the education savings account law, and this has been upheld by state Supreme Courts, it is no longer government money, and that cuts legal connection between the state and the money, which then cuts off the ability of the state to regulate little Johnny for using the money, or if little Johnny's parent directs the money to be sent to a private school, it prevents the state of Oregon from regulating that private school saying, hey, you took government money. No, they didn't, because it's no longer government money. But it basically goes into a pot. Mom never touches the money, so we don't have to worry that she's going to get a boob job or take a Caribbean cruise. She can't touch it, but then she can use the money and she can customize the education that little Johnny needs. Because again, I'm not trying to cut out dads, but I'm a mom and I wrote this, so I always think from the perspective of mom.
Right.
So mom knows what little Johnny needs. So she can then use that money every year to customize. Maybe he's got a slight speech impediment. She can use some of the money for educational therapy. Or maybe he's a little bit behind in math and he needs a tutor. She can then use some of the money to send little Johnny to a religious school or a secular private school, or she can choose to homeschool. Whatever is the setting that is best for little Johnny is what this allows the parent to decide. They get the constitutionally protected right to decide the school setting, and then the money is protected because it's no longer government funds. And then we put in to the constitutional amendment itself several layers of protection to say, get back, Jack. You as the government cannot come over, basically build a big brick wall between the public side and the private side and say, the government shall not jump over the fence and try to regulate over here in the private world. We tell the government they cannot tell mom that she needs to have a teaching certificate or that she has to change the curriculum or that she can only choose this school or not choose that school or that she has to basically be told how she can educate the child. All those are left to the private school and to the parent to decide, and they use this money then to customize what the little Johnny needs. Because again, the parent knows much better than an administrator or a bureaucrat down in Salem who's never even met little Johnny. So mom can then customize it. So she directs the money to be used for these various sources. So she uses some for private school, for tuition or tutoring, education therapy, transportation. And then the real sweet deal about this is that we also are saying that if there's money left over at the end of the year, if mom's frugal and she's able to use less than all the money that she's allocated for that year, the remainder can roll over to the next year. So she'll have that extra coming in that next year. And because maybe that year the child needs a whole bunch of things.
Oh, that's sweet. That's because now they're forced to spend that money on the public school level, right?
Right. Well, yeah. And government accounting is basically, it's not zero sum.
Right.
It's, I got to spend it all so I get that much next year, which is completely screws the taxpayer.
So this kind of fixes a double problem, because that's been a huge problem all along, is that, like you said, they don't start at zero again. They don't, you know, zero budgeting. They just start at, they just go back and look at what you actually spent. And if you didn't spend it, well, you don't get to go that route.
Right. And so in the education savings account arena, if the allocation is somewhere in the neighborhood of $7,600 per year, and that will go up with the budget of the whole school system. But if we just look at it from 7,600, if mom spends 7,000 a year in various customization of educational needs, then 600 will flop over to the next year. And then when the child completes high school, if there's any money left, we specifically designed it to say, now this money can be used for little Johnny to go to college in Oregon, or to go to trade school in Oregon, or vocational school, because the money came from Oregon taxpayers, so we wanted to keep it here. So now there's kids out there, and school choice is geared toward low income and minority and so forth, and it's a freedom ticket for them to rise above and to get a good education. And now there's gonna be thousands of kids out there who, one, didn't think that they were even gonna graduate from high school, and now there's a possibility they're gonna have a college fund or a vocational school fund for them. I mean, it's going to be such a wonderful thing for Oregon, because the whole point of having a tax system that funds education is the direct beneficiaries of those are the students and, of course, the parents, but grandparents and aunts and uncle and people that don't have kids, they're banking on the fact that they're having to pay this boatload of taxes to educate kids who will then become prosperous, graduate with a skill set, go out and earn money and not be a drag on society, not go into jails, not cause even more taxes. And so now we're basically giving a lifeline to a bunch of kids who maybe never thought it was possible. So now they can become welders or carpenters or mechanics, or they can go to Oregon State and be an engineer or whatever. I mean, the possibilities are endless. And that's the point of this money. We're not paying taxes to fund a building or to fund teachers' union or to have a full employment act for all these administrators. It's always about making sure the kid gets the best education. Because if we're not giving them the education, then we're failing. So let's make sure the money follows the kid and the kid gets a good education.
You know, you've just solved, if we could get this passed, you just solved three problems. You've increased competition in the schools, which is what we're lacking. You've made it available and encourage people to be frugal with their money while trying to have the same goal of giving the best education. And you've given them the availability of having the reward of their frugalness by paying for higher education. Wow, this is an incredible deal, Donna. This is just wonderful. I mean, before I go any further, I really am in support of this. Now that I'm talking to you, I'm even more in support of this than ever before. Could you tell people right now, because I'm going to ask you again in a couple of minutes to do this as well, because I want people to hear this as many times as they can. How can they get involved to get these signatures when you go to the full-blown getting all the petitions signed?
Well, our website is www.educationfreedomfororegon. And you can go there, and there's a lot of frequently asked questions. There's a page where you can submit your email. You can get on our list for the newsletter. You can indicate what volunteer capacity you want to be. And we're all just grassroots. We're just a bunch of, you know, a collection of moms and dads doing this. We're not rich. We're not famous. We're not, you know, super skilled. We're just trying to solve a problem. So we are reaching out to all sorts of parents. If you've got a skill set of, you know, how to do marketing or advertising or database management or graphics or all those kind of things, anything you can think of, we need it, because we're just a group of people trying to solve the situation here. Our email is info@educationfreedomfororegon.com. We have a Facebook page, Education Freedom for Oregon, and another Facebook page is Donna Kreitzberg. which is me, and I post all sorts of articles and I keep people apprised of what we're doing. But I want to go back to an issue that we've talked primarily about, the private school choice initiative, which is we build a brick wall between the public and the private sector, and we say that once the money goes into an account, it's no longer government money. We add protections for the moms and the dads of the private schools and say the government can't reach over the wall and regulate. But over in the public school side, we also have an open enrollment amendment for them, because what we are doing here is we're empowering parents with constitutionally protected choice of what school setting is best for them. What we're not doing is telling any particular school to change what you're doing. We're not tyrants, we're not czars, we're just trying to say, look, mom and dad deserve the right to have a voice in the education of their child and choose the school setting. And so for some people, well, right now about 82 to 90% of students go to public school, right? Some because they have to, but for some, that's the great solution and it works for them. And we're not going to say that public schools have to change, or we're not going to tell private schools they have to change. So for the folks who like public schools, what we're bringing to them is, right now you have, we had an open enrollment back in 2012 to 2019, and then it sunsetted and it's gone. So now if you're residentially assigned to a particular school, and for whatever reason that school doesn't serve your child well, you have to basically go on bended knee to your current district and say, please, please let me be free to go somewhere else. And the school district's going to say, heck no, we're not going to let you go, because when you go, the money goes.
Right.
So we're taking away that obstacle, because again, I drafted this as a mom and I'm trying to think, what would I want to do if my kid was in public school? They're all grown, so they're not. So what we decided there was we wanted a statewide, all year round, easy for mom to decide. So if mom lives in one school district, perhaps she works in another, and it's more convenient for her to have little Johnny come with her in the car, go to another school, she can then basically just say, hey, I want to go to this other school district. And if that school has capacity, whether it's a chair in the seventh grade or space in a special needs program, the school has to take the child. So instead of having to ask, please, 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 may I, it's I'm going there if you have room. But we also balance that with the idea that, look, we're not going to tell the public school that you have to, if you're already full, you have to build another floor or bring a modular building in. We know that practicalities, we can't do that.
Right.
So we're just saying, if you have space, you have to take this new student. If you don't have space, just tell us you don't have space, and then mom has to go look elsewhere. But we're trying to make it so that it's all year round, because maybe at the beginning of the school year, school aid is great, but it becomes bad later on for whatever reason. So mom can decide later. And if she wants one school district instead of the other, she gets to choose. So we're really trying to empower the public school parents too, with the best public school, and that includes charter schools. And what our measure also does is, there's been a big brouhaha about the virtual charter schools, where they arbitrarily set a 3% cap on those, because the teachers union hated the idea of virtual schools to begin with. And they said, we're going to sue you every year if you have virtual schools. So finally the legislature sort of threw up its hands and said, God, what can we do to make you go away? And the teachers union basically said, well, we're going to cap it at 3% and then we'll let it happen. Well, 3% is completely arbitrary, and it's not, again, focused on the need of a student. If we Right. need all the students to be in virtual, all the students should be in virtual. So the 3% needs to go bye-bye. Senator Linthicum tried to do that this last short session and it wasn't successful. So we drafted in there that basically says, now that 3% cap, gone. Because again, the focus here is getting little Johnny the best education he can, wherever that is. And so this 3% virtual school cap is ridiculous. And so it's going to be gone. So mom can choose a public school, charter school, all across the state. And if there's room, they take the kid.
Wow, you just answered the three questions I was going to have for you next. You just did a great job. You're doing great. You're making my job really easy here, Donna. But the group Education Freedom for Oregon has two measures that they're going to be wanting you to get signatures for on these petitions for these measures. I'm talking to Donna Kreitzberg. And Donna, one of the things I want to ask you, because I've read the Oregon Constitution, but I'm not don't remember. Does it say in the Constitution, I believe it says something to the extent you have a right to an education, but it doesn't actually tell you how to provide that education. Is that true?
Well, basically, it basically says that there has to be funding for common public education, but it doesn't say that it has to be only in a public government-run school. And in fact, it cannot say that, because back in 1923, the then Governor Pierce tried to have a law that compelled all students to go to public government schools. And the United States Supreme Court said in 1925, no way, Jack, you cannot compel all students to be in public school. You have to allow for the existence of private schools. And most importantly, it is the parents' duty and right to choose the educational setting for their child. So what we're trying to do in these amendments to the Oregon Constitution is codify about 100 years of United States Supreme Court rulings to say that the right of the parent will not be overruled by the legislature. And that basically the parent has the fundamental right to, and it's the oldest fundamental liberty interest recognized by the Supreme Court, the parent has the right in the care, custody, and control of their children. And the 1925 case basically had the language that's always quoted now, which is, the child is not the mere creature of the state. And it's instead that the parents have the right and the duty to direct the education and upbringing of the child. So the Oregon Constitution also doesn't say that all the tax money that's earmarked for education can only be spent at public schools. It's just sort of happened that way because back when the Constitution was written, you know, we were all farmers and we didn't have mobility. We couldn't go very far. So they decided to have, okay, well, let's have a building and let's pass the hat and get some money to build a little one-room schoolhouse. And you know, let's put it near some houses so that people didn't have to walk very far. And then it kind of grew up and it was a public building in the sense that it was supported by, you know, the citizens, but it was never the only opportunity for education. And the Constitution in Oregon that's modeled after Indiana basically says that, and that the courts have held that it's a floor, not a ceiling on what the state can do as far as education. So it's not the exclusive way to educate students. And the money is instead, according to the Oregon Constitution, to be spent on the education of primary and secondary school kids. So it's supposed to be spent for all Oregon K through 12 kids, but it's just sort of organically come up to be only spent in the public schools. And so last year when we submitted our measures, the teachers union lost their mind and thought, oh my gosh, all of a sudden they kind of realized that we're trying to actually follow the Oregon Constitution by having the money follow the student to where the student gets education.
I was just going to say that your measure, the intent of your measures is really what the intent of the decision was in that court case and what the way they interpret it. It seems like you're more in line with what we really wanted or you know what they were saying. The interpretation of this is from that court decision really falls more in line with your measures than what they're pushing by the legislature, which, like you said, is under the thumb of the union.
Exactly. And so the whole point here is we've decided as a society that education of our students is important and we're all going to pony up some money and we're going to have some of it allocated to education because that's a common good that will benefit the student themselves and all the rest of Oregonians. But it was never meant to be only used exclusively at public schools. And the way public schools have sort of morphed into hardly even schools anymore, they've taken on so many other roles and they've increased on average. There's been a slight increase in student enrollment, but there's been an 88% increase in non-teacher staff. And they're doing all these auxiliary rules, you know, about CRT and gender and all this stuff. And they've kind of forgotten their original mission, which was reading, writing, arithmetic, instruction. And so what's happening now is parents are being forced by living in a certain neighborhood to go to a certain school, but that school is sort of only directing an indoctrination of a certain kind of subject that where maybe half the people, they think that's great, but the other half the people don't like that. And yet they have nowhere to go. And if they, and people say, well, just go pay for it yourself. Well, what that's doing then is creating two class systems. There's a, you've already paid your tax and it's going to public school, but if public school doesn't align with your values, yes, you can choose to move into a fancier neighborhood maybe, or you can write another check for private school, but you're being financially punished. And we shouldn't have a system where the common good was to educate our kids in the fundamentals of education and have that now been sort of watered down and shifted to the side and then say, okay, parents, well, you just have to write another check to private school or go do it yourself. So what we're trying to say is, look, we're not changing how schools are. If you like the public school system, you can stay over there and the money will follow the child to that public system. But if that doesn't align with your values, or your little Johnny is not being served well and the needs of the parents aren't being met, the parent can opt out and go over to the private sector, have some of the money and only a portion of the money. We're not even being greedy. We're only asking for effectively half the money, and have that then go to the parent. The parent can direct how it's being spent. And so, again, we're following the Constitution. We're having the money follow where the student gets education, because the whole point here always has to be not focusing on the money itself, but on what the money can achieve, which is a good education for the student. And we've learned now that public schools are not a one-size-fits-all.
Right.
And we're realizing that it doesn't matter if it's a public school classroom or a private school classroom or a home living room. The room doesn't matter. It's the ability of the child to be in a setting that serves the needs of that child. And that's the goal. And that's all we're trying to do here, is to make the money follow and be available so all our kids get a great chance in life. Because the last thing we want to do is have them not have a skill set when they graduate, come out angry, they can't get a job, they hate the society, they go to crime, and now they're costing us more money because they're in prison or they're causing vandalism or whatever. And that's no good for Oregon, and it's definitely no good for those students. And we're doing them a huge disservice. So we're just trying to say, look, we don't know what the best setting is for your child, but mom and dad does. So let's let mom and dad choose whatever that is. And let's make it a constitutionally protected right, so the legislature can't stick their big fat thumb on and tell parents where school they have to be.
And, you know, this is something where, you know, you're going to get a huge amount of support from the people on the right, people who are Christians, people who are of any different religions who want to promote that religion. And it seems like it caters to the people on the left who maybe they want to send their kid who emphasizes gay pride or emphasizes diversity. And so therefore the market, if we allow this competition, would actually be able to provide for not only the educational needs, but maybe even the emotional needs of some of the people who need that emotional stability that they believe they're missing in today's school. You know, what they talk about, the lack of equity and the disparity between certain different groups. A person could focus on that instead of focusing on the academic part of the school. And so it seems like you're creating solutions to the problems on both the right and the left, and anyone else who's just an apparent. I think this is genius, Donna.
Thank you. And it made me think of three thoughts. One is that the polling has been consistently, parents and non-parents, just the public in general, consistently between 70 to over 80% in favor of school choice. And that's across the board. This is not a partisan issue. This is not a
right.
Republicans hate Democrats and it's all for, you know, whatever. And it's not a religious issue. It's not a, it's just taking care of the kids. And so whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, NAV, whatever, consistently 70 to 80% in favor of the concept of school choice and freedom. Because again, we love our kids. This is just
right.
about the kids. We don't have to put labels of what your party is or worrying about the money. So the first thing is that it polls well with everybody because we love our kids and we want our kids to have a great education.
Yes.
The second thing that's important is there have been lots and lots of studies that show that this thing called competition is really good for public schools too, which is kind of unusual. I mean, they're used to having the buses deliver all these kids to the door. They don't have to listen to the concerns of the
yeah.
parent, and they don't care about what the kids get. But now when they have competition, teacher salaries go up because they don't want to lose teachers to the private world.
Right.
And the needs of the parents are listened to, and the kids now finally get a better education.
I got to get
take a break.
thank you, Donna. I got to get going. We got to get you out of here one more time. Give that website address real quick.
Sure. EducationFreedomForOregon.com. And the email is info@EducationFreedomForOregon.com.
Thank you, Donna, and I will have you back on here because this is an issue that I'm going to get involved with. Thank you so much.